Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The Global Story is the podcast helping you make sense of the news. Join me, Katya Adler, every weekday as I take a closer look at the stories making the headlines with insights from the BBC's global network of experts. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and at 14 hours GMT on Friday the 8th of December, these are our main stories. There's an important announcement from Russia's leader.
Now is such a time when a decision needs to be made. I will run for the position of President of the Russian Federation.
In completely unsurprising news, Vladimir Putin says he'll stand for another term as president. As Israel's military continues to bombard Gaza, there are more deaths in the West Bank. And North Korea is using factories it operated with the South again, but it didn't tell them. Also in this podcast, is Saudi Arabia using vast sums of money in sport to change its image abroad? We speak to a senior Saudi leader.
No one's perfect, and we acknowledge that. And we are reforming. And these events help us reform.
And how do you find the best honey from bees? Well, it's obvious, isn't it? You ask the birds. But let's start in Russia, where Vladimir Putin has announced that he will stand for re-election as the country's president. During a televised meeting at the Kremlin with Russian soldiers who had fought in Ukraine, Mr. Putin was praised for his determination, and he was then asked whether he would run for president again in 2024. His answer will have surprised just about nobody.
Thank you very much. I won't hide that at times I had different thoughts, but now is such a time when a decision needs to be made. I will run for the position of president of the Russian Federation.
Well, Vladimir Putin clearly wrestling with the decision there. Voting is due to take place in March. Also among those not surprised by this is my colleague Vitaly Shevchenko.
This isn't a surprise at all. In fact, a lot of people are wondering, what is the point? Why is Vladimir Putin even bothering holding elections? Because political life, real political life, is outlawed in Russia. We know that if he runs, he is going to win, unless he chooses to appoint somebody else to win, which is unlikely. But the answer to that is, like so many strongman leaders across the world who have been accused of being dictators, very few of them admit being dictators. A lot of them are very keen to maintain this democratic facade. So that's why Vladimir Putin is heavily focused on procedure and laws and what he calls managed democracy.
OK, but obviously I sense your scepticism there, but on the face of it, Russia has a democratic system, doesn't it, where it elects its president. What's the process going to be?
There are a number of parties, but the fact is that genuine opponents of Vladimir Putin have ended up in jail, in exile, or dead. In fact, over the past few days, we've seen a story about a campaign launched by supporters of Alexei Navalny, who is the most prominent Russian opposition leader, who is in jail, of course. So these people, they put up huge posters across Russia saying Russia and a QR code. But if you scan that QR code, it takes you to an anti-Putin website. Guess what happened to those posters? They have been removed because genuine opposition to Vladimir Putin is outlawed, and whatever parties are going to be allowed to run in those elections next March, they are possibly going to make vaguely, mildly critical statements of Vladimir Putin, but they will stop short of challenging his policies in real terms.
OK, so is your view that the world, be you in Ukraine or be you in China or anywhere else, should prepare for another 6 years of Vladimir Putin?
At least, because that's what the system is geared up to do. That's what the system is designed to do. It is designed to make sure that Vladimir Putin stays in power. In fact, it's interesting how Russia's official state news agency, TASS, reported the announcement that Vladimir Putin is going to run for president. It said that he has agreed to run for president.
And he's being urged by people, apparently.
That's what his spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, said, that there are so many people writing in, urging him to run again, that he didn't really have much choice but to agree.
Vitaly Shevchenko, and just a quick aside to that, if you look at the story we have on this at BBC News Online, you will see this. Vladimir Putin, who is 71, has already been in power in Russia longer than any ruler since Joseph Stalin. And a new term, if he was successful, would see him remain as president until at least 2030. Now, the war in Gaza is in its third month. As the humanitarian situation for hundreds of thousands of Gazans worsens, Israel's military continues its heavy bombardment amid intense fighting with Hamas. Overnight, hundreds more targets were struck across the Gaza Strip. Local journalists describe the intensity of those attacks. Hossam Shabat reports from the north of Gaza.
The Israeli army deployed a substantial number of smoke bombs, resulting in numerous injuries and individuals struggling to breathe. Several houses, cars and tents in shelter centres are engulfed in large, uncontrollable fires. As of now, there's a state of severe panic and terror among the citizens in the shelter schools, where no one can take effective action. Everyone is trapped amidst the bombs and fires, and despite the absence of advancing army tanks, the surroundings are dominated by constant smoke bombs and fire.
Well, as the aerial campaign escalates, pressure on Israel has been growing to allow desperately needed humanitarian supplies into Gaza. Hannah Bond from the charity ActionAid UK told the BBC that sufficient volumes of basic supplies were still not getting in.
The situation is absolutely catastrophic. People are lacking in food, in water, in fuel to cook food. Hospitals are lacking in fuel to be able to have operations and to do those really important surgeries. We're hearing from our partner in northern Gaza that they are having to operate with shrapnel flying around.
The government of Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that facilities at another crossing into the territory would be opened soon. The bloodshed has also been increasing on the West Bank, where officials say six Palestinians were killed when Israeli soldiers stormed a refugee camp there. Just before we recorded this podcast, I spoke to our correspondent Anna Foster, who's in Jerusalem.
We have seen over the last week this increasing bombardment, particularly since a week ago today that brief ceasefire deal that lasted a week broke down. And I was there, you know, in Sderot in southern Israel, looking out across Gaza when we heard the fighting start to resume. And since then, the focus, which had very much been the north of Gaza, has also started to move south as well. So we're really seeing these intense bombardments up and down the strip. Israel say that they are continuing to focus on Hamas infrastructure, particularly in areas in the north, like the Jabalia refugee camp, for example, but also around that large southern city of Khan Yunis as well. But I think Israel has had it made very clear to them that this is not an open-ended war, and that there will be eventually a time limit put on this conflict.
Can I talk to you about the pressure that the Israel's government is under to open some more crossings to increase the humanitarian aid into Gaza? I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu's government saying that they are going to open part, I think, at Kerem Shalom. How important is the humanitarian effort, and in particular its ability to go through these places?
So Kerem Shalom will help. It offers an extra space where those checks can be done, because every one of those humanitarian aid lorries that goes in needs to be thoroughly checked first of all. So Kerem Shalom gives them an extra staging post to do that, and it will improve the flow. It will make things quicker. But you still really have the Rafah crossing as the sole crossing that aid is actually passing through. there are signs that that flow is starting to get a little better, but it's still a long way away from where it needs to be to help all of those civilians in Gaza who need it.
And just finally, much of our reporting focuses on the military campaign and the confrontation in the Gaza Strip, but I think there's more violence and there have been more deaths in the West Bank. And the funerals, have they started yet today?
Yeah, there have been 6 funerals today. And there's a good point, because this is the kind of thing that would very much be the focus of the world's attention if it was happening in a different context. Large numbers of Palestinians in the West Bank who've been killed since the 7th of October. The West Bank had been boiling, really, for a long time before that. So this is not something that's just been provoked solely by the 7th of October. There was already a great deal of anger and frustration in the West Bank, areas like Nablus, like Jenin. This, again, is something that needs to be looked at, and it's important. It needs to be looked at in the wider context of what is happening in Gaza, and also in the wider context of how some sort of resolution to this conflict is sought, because it's not just about finding an answer for Gaza. It's about finding an answer that tries to work for the whole of this area, for the occupied West Bank as well as Gaza. But as we know, through decades and decades of negotiations and attempts to try and find an answer, very often it proves to be out of reach.
Anna Foster in Jerusalem. In the US, President Biden's son Hunter has been charged with tax evasion as part of an investigation into his personal and business dealings. Prosecutors say he took part in a scheme to avoid paying at least $1.4 million. Hunter Biden's lawyers say if his client had a different name, there would be no charges. David Willis has more.
The 56-page indictment alleges Hunter Biden earned millions of dollars from foreign entities in China and Ukraine and used much of it to fund what prosecutors call an extravagant lifestyle, one that included drugs, prostitutes, and exotic cars. He's accused of plotting to avoid paying taxes between the years 2016 and 2019 and filing a false tax assessment for the year 2018. Hunter Biden had already been accused in September of lying about his drug use in order to buy a handgun, the first criminal prosecution of a sitting American president's child. If convicted of the latest charges, he faces up to 17 years in prison.
David Willis reporting. North Korea is thought to have reopened 30 factories at an industrial park that was built by South Korea, even though that park is supposed to be closed. Seoul said Pyongyang had restarted facilities at the Gaesong Industrial Complex, which is built on the northern side of the border dividing both countries. When it opened many years ago, it was seen as an important step towards cooperation between the two Koreas. Our East Asia editor, Mickey Bristow, told me more.
It's easy to forget such a time existed, really, because over the last few years, we've heard quite a lot about tension between North and South Korea. North Korea testing missiles, recently put a satellite into space, a military spy satellite. And so it's hard sometimes to remember that 20 years ago, there was something called a sunshine policy where the two Koreas got together and actually relations were quite warm, and there were a number of projects which they took part in together to try and cement those ties, and the Gaesong Industrial Complex was one of those. And at its height, it was quite a big deal, really. There were 120-odd South Korean companies operating factories in this site just over the border on the northern side of the border into North Korea. And it employed more than, at one point, 50,000 North Korean workers, as well as hundreds who used to travel every day from the south. And this earned an awful lot of money, not just for those North Korean workers, but for the North Korean economy. And remember, at the time, North Korea was just coming out of a really major famine, really trying to reorganize its economy. So it was a really big deal. Occasionally over the years, it closed down a little bit because of tension. And then in 2016, it closed finally. The South Koreans closed it down because of the continuing weapons programs by North Korea.
So, all right, 7 years on. I mean, this is a very significant investment, wasn't it? What do we think is actually happening now?
Well, what's been happening since then, that, according to the South Koreans, is these factories essentially have been idle. They've just been sitting there, not used. But this year, the South Koreans started to notice that there was some activity at some of these sites, mainly through satellite imagery, noticing workers turning up in buses, a lot more activity around some of the factories. And earlier this year, they suggested that perhaps 10 of the facilities were being used. Now they've come out and said that there's 30 or so, they think, 30 factories being used illegally in South Korean terms by the North Koreans, because essentially these are South Korean factories, South Korean facilities, and the North Koreans are just seem to be operating them.
And just very, very quickly, I think I know the answer. Seoul wants Pyongyang to stop. Is it going to stop?
Probably not.
Mickey Bristow. French police say they've arrested two men in Strasbourg for defrauding old people by pretending to eradicate bedbugs. France has been gripped by a nationwide panic over the insects since October. Hugh Schofield explains.
The two men were arrested in the eastern city of Strasbourg, where it's alleged they'd fine-tuned their racket, phoning up elderly women with a claim that bedbugs had been detected in their area and then insisting on a home visit to treat the non-existent infestation. After spraying the walls with a basic cleaning product and offering an ointment for skin protection, they then charged hundreds of euros on the person's bank card. Altogether, 48 victims have been detected, police said. October's bedbug scare was fueled by a huge amount of coverage on social media, and consumers groups in France have warned that many of the offers of professional help available online are not to be trusted.
Hugh Schofield. Coming up in the Global News podcast, at the Climate Change Conference in Dubai, we hear about reasons to be cheerful.
In China, across 2023, they're on track to add more solar than the United States has ever installed. Even in Britain, some 17,000 homes a month are installing panels.
Something mysterious plagues County Mayo on the west coast of Ireland and its legendary Gaelic football team.
I believe in the curse. Yeah, I think it's real.
Is it just superstition? Or could there be more to it?
Sometimes I think there's something sinister going on.
What do we need to do to win an All-Ireland final for Mayo?
Listen to the curious tale of the Mayo curse on Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service. Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome back to the Global News Podcast. There are military developments in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where an East African regional force is withdrawing its troops. The soldiers were sent to the east of the DRC at the request of the Congolese government, with a mandate that included helping retake areas that had been seized by the M23 rebel group. But President Felix Tshisekedi, who is up for re-election soon, has criticised them for being ineffective, as our senior Africa correspondent Anne Soy told me.
From the point of view of government in Kinshasa, and it's very interesting that it's coming just days to a very important election. So these forces have already started withdrawing. We understand that that exercise will go on until January. They're supposed to be replaced by forces from the South African Development Community. The DRC is part of that SADC community, but it is not clear when that replacement will happen.
And the rebel groups, we mentioned M23 just before we spoke to you. Any reaction from them in terms of operations on the ground or any kind of statement?
We have seen enough, essentially been trying to extend their territory. And as late as yesterday, they took a town called Mushaki, which is just about 40 kilometres from the capital of North Kivu, the province that has all these troubles. So they're continuing with that campaign. They had been dialogue before, and they had agreed to let go of some of the territory that they had taken previously, which was then to be taken over by the forces that are now withdrawing. So we are seeing that as a very clear reaction to the withdrawal of these forces, their extension of territory that they control.
And just briefly, the election that's coming up, I mean, the extent to which there's faith in the legitimacy and this is going to be a transparent exercise.
Well, that's what the government is promising to deliver, but there are also already questions being asked past, the European Union has withdrawn its observer mission, saying that there are no security guarantees for their observers who are already in the capital, Kinshasa, but they wanted to travel outside and you know, around the country, but there were no security guarantees. And therefore, you know, it puts to question the credibility and the transparency that the upcoming election is going to be held in.
Anne Soy talking to me from Nairobi. Well, let's stay on the continent because congestion at a key African port is causing potential supply problems ahead of the busy Christmas period. Some 60 ships, each laden with thousands of large packed shipping containers, are stuck at Durban Harbour. It's the largest and busiest shipping terminal in sub-Saharan Africa. Victoria Uwankunda spoke to Ian Petty, who's the managing director of a worldwide relocation firm in Johannesburg.
There are about 60, 70,000 containers stranded out in the sea outside of the Durban port. There's around 50, 60 vessels in total that are out at sea. We flew over helicopters over the harbour a few days ago. There are many empty berths and idle cranes in the Durban harbour, the Durban port. And our biggest issue is that Transnet, who is a parastatal running our Durban ports, are trying to do a lot, but they have not got the... They haven't embraced digitalization. We are sitting with lots of infrastructure problems where we haven't been maintaining gantries. And so we're sitting in an absolute pandemonium, particularly now before Christmas. As they say that the 60, 70,000 containers is going to take at least 18 weeks to clear. And that's going to be well after Christmas. So unfortunately, retail stores are in dire straits.
You call it a pandemonium, retails are in dire straits and 18 weeks, but we recently spoke to the CEO at the Durban Chamber of Commerce who told us that things were improving.
A few days ago, the Transnet did sign an agreement with, they call it the OEM, which is original manufacturers of all the different equipment they have in port. They reckon there's going to be in the next 2 weeks a 30% increase in the straddle carrier capacity, but the OEMs are prioritizing a three-month list for demand material. So in other words, they're prioritizing over 3 months. So 3 months ain't going to help us for Christmas. So they are trying to do everything. They did also, 6 months ago, we signed an agreement, a 15-year contract agreement with a Philippine terminal operator. And that was 6 months ago. And they're still not on the ground because of Transnet leadership void. There's a problem trying to hand over to them. And the Filipino terminal operator have certainly got they've embraced all the maritime digitalization that we need desperately in port to help us streamline and get containers moving in and out of Durban port.
Ian Petty, who works in relocation, speaking there from Johannesburg. Saudi Arabia is going to host the 2034 Football World Cup. It's just signed up a top golfer for its controversial LIV Golf Tour with a reported $300 million payday, and it's hoping to become a global hub for big boxing bouts. All that as it tries to modernise and change its image on the world stage. All part, though, of what critics say is sport washing. Well, our sports editor Dan Rowan met Saudi's sports minister, Prince Abdulaziz bin Turki Al Faisal, to test those claims.
It's the country transforming the sporting landscape, whether it's shaking up football or the hosting of boxing's biggest fights. Saudi Arabia's investments have gone into overdrive, and the man overseeing it all told me what lies behind this sporting revolution.
Our ambition is to host the best events around the world and the kingdom for the people of the kingdom to see, but also to invite the world to the kingdom.
Do you want to be the sort of number one sporting superpower?
I don't see it that we're competing with others. Okay. 20 million of our population are below the age of 30, so we need to get them engaged.
Al Hilal versus Al Nasser in the Saudi Pro League. Clubs here spent £750 million signing top stars this summer, sending shockwaves through the game. While the Riyadh derby is a sellout, some matches have been watched by just a few hundred fans.
Having lured some of the game's biggest names here, Saudi Arabia's remarkable spending spree, both in the Pro League and beyond, is generating plenty of hype and potentially growth too. But it's also forcing sports to confront difficult questions over the disruption that all this investment is causing and the motivation that lies behind it.
Despite fears over the environmental impact and concerns that sports use to improve the reputation of a country where women's rights are restricted and homosexuality is illegal, the World Cup's now set to come here in 2034.
For those who say that Saudi Arabia is not a suitable host, what would your message be to them?
We've hosted a lot of events in the past, more than 85 events. Everyone's welcome in the kingdom. Like any other nations and around the world, we have rules and regulations that everyone should abide by and respect.
So when you're accused of sports washing, does that frustrate you?
It's very shallow on what they... And I'm sure that a lot of the people that accuse us of that haven't been to Saudi or haven't seen what we're doing on the ground.
Human rights campaigners will say, well, look at the imprisoning of campaigners for women's rights.
No one's perfect, and we acknowledge that. And we are reforming. And these events help us reform.
Saudi Arabia's sports minister there speaking to Dan Rowan. Now, let's stay in that part of the world because we're reporting on the annual climate change conference a lot at the moment. It's happening in Dubai and it's just about to head into its second and usually crucial week. The man in charge is Sultan Al Jaber, who also happens to be the head of Abu Dhabi's national oil company. He's urged leaders and governments at the talks to step up, telling them they could deliver what he called a paradigm shift in the next few days. Despite the warnings of record global warming, rises in sea levels and growing extreme weather, our correspondent Matt McGrath, who's in Dubai, reports that many climate change experts believe there is actually much to be hopeful about.
Electricity made from solar is not only the world's cheapest form of energy, it's probably the cheapest electricity in history. Solar panels are going up all over the world at astonishing speed. In China, across 2023, they're on track to add more solar than the United States has ever installed. Even in cold, grey Britain, there's a secret solar revolution going on. Some 17,000 homes a month are installing panels.
What you could do with those is put them flat on the ground and tie them, and then when the wind stops, we can put them back up.
Hilary Powell has been the driving force behind a push for local solar on her street in East London. Not only are the panels cutting energy bills, she says, they're allowing people to take practical steps in the fight against climate change.
It's not just about renewable energy, but it's about kind of people power. All of us realising that together we can take action and do something practical to counter the kind of effects of climate breakdown and the economic crisis.
China is also a major force behind the advent of electric vehicles, which is another reason to be hopeful about climate change. Not only can EVs cut emissions from transport, they also have the potential to put cash in your pocket. A technology called vehicle-to-grid means these batteries on wheels can power your house and send energy to the national grid. Topping up when electricity is cheap means you can turn a profit by selling it back to the energy system when demand and prices are high.
What is happening to our world? Have you ever stopped to notice?
The Pacific island of Vanuatu is taking a lawsuit on climate change to the International Court of Justice, and they're using all options, including song, to make their case.
Lives are being lost.
In the next year or so, court rulings such as this one will give greater clarity as to who's responsible for climate damage. Jeffrey Simon is one of America's top litigators, currently taking a $52 billion damages case against a range of oil and gas companies. He says the courts are a real reason for hope when it comes to global warming.
People who deny climate change as a result of carbon pollution, largely from the burning of fossil fuels, are either gaslighting you, pun intended, or they are simply misinformed because the science is overwhelming.
As political leaders and their negotiating teams meet here at COP28, one important reason for optimism is history. Just 8 years ago, when the Paris Climate Agreement was signed, the remarkable document didn't contain any mention of coal, oil or gas, the main drivers of climate change. Here in Dubai, among the ceremonial drummers, there's a real hope that the parties will agree to finally end the use of these fuels in some shape or form this century. That would consign to history the root cause of global warming and give the world a fighting chance of defeating our biggest collective threat.
Matt McGrath reporting from Dubai. Let's end this podcast on the birds and the bees, actual birds and bees. Since ancient times, honey hunters in parts of Africa have relied on wild birds to help them find honey. So have a listen to this, some very different calls used by people, first of all in Tanzania, then Mozambique. So, what does all that mean? Well, researchers here in the UK at the University of Cambridge have discovered that the birds recognise familiar calls and are far more likely to help people from their own area. One of those researchers is Claire Spottiswood. She's in Mozambique at the moment, and she's been speaking on a slightly wobbly line to my colleague Martha Carney.
The greater honey guide, who you heard giving those chattering calls in those recordings, is a species of African bird that loves to eat beeswax, which is very rich in energy. But this is only possible if you're first able to overcome the thousands of stinging honeybees that defend their nests. So honey guides are very good at knowing where bees' nests are, whereas human honey hunters aren't quite as good at finding bees' nests, but they have the skills to use fires to subdue the stinging bees and open their nests. So honey guides seek us out as humans. They come to us and they attract our attention with those specialised chattering calls that you heard and guide us from tree to tree to show us a bee's nest and wait for us to harvest it for
our
skills.
It is a wonderful story of collaboration. But then your research has discovered how discriminating the birds can be, and they know the difference between their local honey hunters and calls from outside their area.
Human honey hunters signal to honey guides using those specialised calls. And these vary among cultures from a whistled melody to a trill and a grunt, or in some cases, whoops and whistles. So there's this immense human cultural variation across Africa that honey guides need to contend with.
And when the birds help the human beings to find the honey, what happens then? Just explain to us how the honey is extracted.
Yes, so once the bird and human reach their joint quarry together, which is the bee's nest, the bird tends to fall quiet and just give a few small high-pitched noises, and that's a signal to the human that they've arrived. And at that point, the humans will often tap the trees with axes to see where bees are emerging, and that tells them that they've found the nest, and they can then light a fire and add plenty of green leaves to add smoke and harvest the nest using their axes. All through this time, the bird just waits quietly, waiting for its own reward, which is the empty wax combs that are left behind once the humans have left with what they want, which is a large bucket of honey.
Claire Spottiswood speaking from Mozambique with the birds, the bees and the honey. Well, that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email, as always. Our address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Craig Kingham. The producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Until next time, thanks for listening and goodbye.